I'm going to call the Labor Commerce Committee to order. We've got attendance Representative Taylor, Representative Parnell, Representative Finkelstein. We're taking up where we left off House Bill 425. We'll start with any public testimony anyone wants to offer other than the division. Anyone in attendance want to give any public testimony? House Bill 425? Okay, if the people from the division could join us, everyone's welcome at the table. We'll start to see you. You're going to have to remind me exactly what section we left off on. I think it was on page 6. For the committee's recall, page 6, where it says chapter 27, in the sectional analysis, where we are. We do have, since the last meeting, a memo from Gloria on issue of independent directors. Representative Donnelly brought that up last meeting, so we'll wait until the time which he's in attendance to go back to that. The system we've been using is having the division run through the sectional analysis and basically just note the sections that are conforming or technical without any explanation, and for those that involve any substantive change in the law, to describe what they do, and committee members will just interrupt, jump in when they have a question of any sort. Don, you want to start that?
Thank you, sir. My name is, for the record, Don Koch. I'm Chief of the Market Surveillance Section with the Division of Insurance, and with me is Gloria Glover, who is our Chief Financial Examiner, and Stan Garlington is an insurance analyst in my section. Stan has been very heavily involved in the drafting of much of this portion that we're about to start on, Chapter 27. Gloria has been very heavily involved in the whole process, and she chaired the our Statutes and Regulations Committee that basically put this whole package together. If it meets with your approval, I'd like to start with Stan and have him run us through Chapter 27, which I believe starts on page 6 of the sectional analysis.
Great. That'd be fun.
Okay. Perhaps a little background on how we came to the Chapter 27 that's included and that we'll be discussing will be a little helpful conceptually. When we looked at adding the reinsurance intermediary model and the MGA model, which were accreditation requirements.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Could you use English for us? Like MGA, I'm surprised that's,
okay.
That's an old English card. 25 years ago.
Okay. Managing general agents.
Okay.
Managing general agents are licensees who act on behalf of insurers and perform administrative functions for them. As a result of insolvencies and impaired insurers like Mission and some of the others, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners felt that the regulation of managing general agents and reinsurance intermediaries was inadequate. And through a long process among regulators with substantial working with those in industry who were involved, model acts were developed which addressed the good business practices that all agreed managing general agents, or in regard to the reinsurance intermediaries should be followed.
Okay, this was done by your association.
Yes.
Correct.
If I may add one thing more, Stan. MGAs frequently have what's called the pen of the insurance company. In other words, they have, by contract, the authority to do things on behalf of the insurance company that typically only the insurance company does, such as accept business or to adjust claims. And they do that fairly autonomously. Mission, as Stan has noted, was an insolvency in which it was found that the insurer had very little control over what that managing general agent was doing. Another example would be Union Indemnity of New York. where they would give out authority to managing general agents and never again darken their door. I, in fact, did an examination on an MGA back in Indianapolis for the union indemnity, and they told me, well, the MGA had been in the office the day before, so I asked what the nature of the visit was, and they said, well, we went out for coffee, and that was it. They never looked at files, they never looked at procedures or anything. And that's very dangerous because the insurer then has no idea what that MGA, managing general agent, is accepting for them. And so this basically instills, is intended to instill some good sound business practices and controls both on the part of the insurer and the managing general agent so that that kind of thing can't happen.
Okay, maybe I'd like you just open the question up and maybe pursue it from it. And maybe this has already been covered because I was missing last week. Sorry about that, but I'm very interested in knowing how this ends up then with us through you when the insurance company theoretically hires that agent and writes a contract for those express services. Do those contracts not address all these things that you're just now describing? If the insurance company wants to watch their rear end and be covered, whatever happened to the contractual agreement between the agent and the insurance company to force us to have to do something like this? Aren't they supposed to look out for their own situation? It isn't private enterprise wanting to do things without having government involved, but it sounds like they're not doing that, and now they're asking us to do it.
Indeed, many of the contracts do cover an audit process, but in many cases it's not utilized by the insurer. The fact that the insolvencies occurred, the fact that the federal government is criticizing state regulation because it hasn't assured that those contracts are adhered to, and that the relationships between insurers and managing general agents wasn't a bit more structured, if you will, in spite of the contract. Those things all led to the development of this model legislation, which is part of the accreditation package. And you're right. You know, the contracts do often spell it out, but they don't necessarily have anything other than their contract that requires them to do the things that are in that contract.
And what happens to the liability culture, and then does it shift off of those two parties and on the government because government will step in and require these new kinds of things? Where does the liability track? Once that takes place?
Basically, it would track with the two parties. The state of Alaska or any other regulatory body is not responsible.
So we're not liable.
No.
No, sir. We don't assume a liability for that. Interestingly enough, the liability assumption for the misdeeds of the two parties in that case ends up falling on all the other insurers through the Guarantee Association Act, where once an insolvency occurs, everybody else has to pick up the pieces.
And they have their own umbrella to cover that then? Is that what you're
typically
saying?
Typically not. There's an act that's already in statute that's 2180. It's called the Guarantee Association Act. And what it basically provides is that if an insurer goes insolvent, all of the other insurers on a post-assessment basis have to come in and pay for that insolvency. So there's a strong interest on the part of industry to see that, indeed, there is some oversight. And that's the piece that's been kind of missing because there's been some question as to what authority we have to apply these oversights. There's been a very strong question as to whether we have the ability to require that the contract be more formal. This model, in fact, goes through and describes some things that have to be part of the contract. It describes a number of things that both parties have to do in terms of audit, the right of the insurer to examine the books of the MGA. And I'm not totally familiar with all the pieces of it. I think Gloria can help us on that as well as Stan. But a lot of these things have been brought up by lawsuits where it was found that the absence of specific language in the contract left some real advantages to the person who wanted to play some games or to take advantage of an insurer. And in fact, there are some cases, I believe Myron was one of them, I can't remember the site right now, but there was a case where a managing general agent was given the pen of an insurer. Apparently, the contract wasn't sufficiently taught in terms terms of how they would go about canceling, or at what point the insurer could step in and say, wait a minute, you're doing this all wrong, stop. The insurer basically, once it gave its pen away, couldn't get it back. And that firm took the insurer down. And that thing's been in the courts, and I don't know what the resolution of it was. But it certainly pointed up to the NAIC that there had to be a bit more structure to those things. The NAIC being the, sorry about this, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. I too get into the habit of using acronyms, so I'll do my best to avoid that.
Thank you. I didn't mean to sidetrack you. Maybe this has already been covered before, and if it has, maybe I can name it.
Not exactly. Outside. Not exactly, but I think it relates. And
appreciate that. Thanks.
In looking at the new licenses and in reviewing the current licensing arrangement within Title 21, we found that there were bits and pieces of licensing in a whole slew of chapters, and felt it would be very helpful to industry to combine all of the licensing in one chapter. If they'd only have to look one place to determine the type of licenses they need, what the qualifications are, what operating requirements may exist, and what their regulatory responsibilities were. So we started from that standpoint. We also took into consideration numerous suggestions from various licensees and types of licensees, one of which is the very much desired biennial licensing. So we looked at establishing a framework in which licenses would last 2 years for renewal instead of the annual. Out of all that, we come up with Chapter 27. The way it ended up being structured is Article 1 is a generic treatment. General qualifications and treats general licensing matters for all licenses. Separate articles address each particular licensing specialty, and then the last article incorporates the definitions. Starting with Section 48, AS 2127-010, this is the general section which requires that someone be licensed if they're going to act or represent to be a licensee. We incorporated the new reinsurance intermediary broker license, the new reinsurance intermediary manager license, the revised licensing for managing general agents who had previously been called general agents within the statute. We relocated surplus line brokers from Chapter 34 into Chapter 27. Previously, parts of licensing surplus line brokers have been the surplus lines law in Chapter 34, which then referenced back to parts of Chapter 27. And retained the licensing of independent adjusters. We also took a look at whether to go to a single producer licensing system. Currently, individuals may be licensed as an insurance agent, insurance broker, or a solicitor. In reality, because so much of the Alaska insurance market involves brokerage relationships, many of the licensees have to have both an agent and broker license for them to operate efficiently and to provide the needs of their clients. We felt that a single producer license would reduce the number of licenses people had to have, and we would allow the relationship between the client, the insurer, and the insurance producer to address whether that individual were acting as an agent on behalf of the insurance company or a broker would be acting as an independent contractor on behalf of the client. We clarified the treatment of third-party administrators to indicate that if they were only handling claims on behalf of an insurer as a third-party administrator. They can be licensed as an independent adjuster rather than as a managing general agent. We included the requirement that use of a fictitious name or alias be disclosed to the division and be requested online. Yes?
Thank you. For instance, my real name is Elizabeth, but I'm well known as Betty. If I had a license under the name Betty, that would be illegal then? Is that what they're saying? And it must be disclosed separately and reflected on the license?
Oh, it wouldn't be illegal. You just need to tell us about it. So when we get a call inquiring regarding Betty or something else, we'd know about it. The main impetus for including this provision is over the last 4 or 5 years, we've had so many firms combine, merge, go out of business, sell pieces of business. And they tended to keep on using the old name. And it was very confusing because we'd get a phone call coming in for a name that was no longer licensed. And it wasn't clear. So it's just a mechanism so that there's a record of any name that you're operating.
So you're not looking at nicknames? I mean, it would still
no.
be legal. Okay. Just checking.
Okay. It's primarily a informational so that we know what names are being used and who's tied to them.
It's really aimed at the DBAs that's doing business as.
Right. So technically, the way this one sentence is worded, I would feel that I've done it somewhere else.
It's an exceptional analysis. You
that's true.
You have to go back here to see what the thing
exact
says.
Exact wording, yeah.
That's just
okay.
A summary.
We're going through the section analysis just to speed up. You know,
okay.
The
process. We also did a number of clarifications in regard to people who were accepted from being licensed. And in particular, addressing employees of admitted insurers and addressing people who perform management functions similar to what a managing general agent does if they are affiliated with an insurer. We relocated some of the exceptions which have been treated in Chapter 90 as exceptions to definitions. We felt it more appropriate that they be exceptions to the requirement of licensure, and so we relocated into Section 010. We also addressed that a person who was acting as an attorney in fact for a reciprocal didn't need to be licensed under Chapter 27. Basically as a managing general agent would be licensed as an attorney in fact under the reciprocal chapter. This was a refinement that had developed as reciprocals became concerned that their attorney in facts would have to be licensed as managing general agents, and the managing general agent requirements were different than the operation for an attorney in fact. So we treated the NAIC developed a model for attorneys in fact and incorporated that in Chapter 75. We also, as you'll see later, addressed some of the concerns of the local domestic reciprocals like the Timber Exchange and Eureka in regard to wholly owned attorneys in fact that were operating their reciprocals. Need to have an unnecessary additional license.
Is that attorney an on-premise attorney or could be an independent
attorneys in fact
it's not even an attorney. It's a person with power.
Yeah.
It could be anybody.
He's the person with the authority. He's the person with the authority to operate that insurer on behalf of the members of that insurer. Okay. An attorney in fact becomes a term of art, but and that is incidentally clarified when we get to Chapter 75, where there's in the past been reference to just attorney, and that's been defined as attorney in fact. Now, we've jumped that, and we've gone to attorney in fact wherever we mean attorney in fact, because that person, there has been confusion as to whether that person had to be an attorney or not, and in fact, they don't have to be.
And then, are they residents with the firm, or are they outside counsel?
That's a good question.
It's a variety in dealing with Timber Exchange and RECA. Basically, they are a wholly owned entity. It's group in RECA's case, a group of the rural electric associations banded together, formed a reciprocal insurer, set up an attorney, in fact, operated on behalf of themselves. And other entities, especially back east, there have been a number of reciprocal insurers who were formed by the attorney in fact. Attorney in fact would say, well, we're going to have a reciprocal, take advantage of some of the capital and surplus and other organizational requirements and being able to focus on a very limited area.
Yeah, I'm still
and they invest the capital.
Question, I think what I'm asking is, does this term of art and this, it's got to be a person who is an attorney in fact. Does that person reside within this group under the roof of their operation, or does this person contract out their services to them and reside across town in their own little office doing 10 other contracts for 10 other people?
The answer
yes.
is both.
Okay.
The answer is both.
That's all I wanted to know.
Yeah.
Thank
okay.
you. Move on.
There had been a number of problems with the old definitional exceptions to the fine line between clerical employees who did not need to be licensed and employees who, because of their contacts with clients and because of their contacts with insurers, needed to have the level of knowledge to act professionally would require licensure. So through a long process with the industry representatives and analysis with the division, we were far more precise in setting out the types of things that unlicensed people may do and the type of things that required licensing. We were also concerned in that area with what might be called absentee licensees. We'd encountered situations in which the only people at a place of business were clerical people while the licensee was gone on extended vacation and so forth. So we wanted to tie more clearly the concept that somebody who's licensed has to be available and actually operating the business. And to be very specific regarding the type of things that unlicensed people can and can't do. Any questions on that?
Just generic. Do they have a list of those questions and who they're protecting or not protecting as a result of creating the list of the things they can and can't do? Is the list derived from potentially being competitive with somebody else who's doing striking a similar kind of thing?
It would apply to all licensees, so to that extent, it wouldn't be advantageous or disadvantageous. It would be fair to say that during the course of developing this, everybody who participated on the industry side would look at it in terms of how they currently operate, and so they would be concerned with having it structured so that it would fit best with their means of operation. Obviously, with several thousand licensees in Alaska, there are a variety of ways they operate, and what is included is basically a middle ground balancing the different types of operations, and something that the division felt comfortable with in terms of providing a proper balance in terms of disclosure by someone who's not licensed, that they're not licensed, so that a consumer coming in wouldn't assume that they were dealing with a licensed insurance producer when in fact they were dealing with an unlicensed clerical person, and balancing that with an efficient agency operation.
And will we not endure or experience then down the road, 2 months, 3 months, before, if this ever comes to floor, will we not necessarily endure someone who comes running in and all of a sudden points out how unbalanced it is at this stage for them, who may have pointed out it was unbalanced before, but these kept right on being developed, regardless of their input or participation.
With a bill this size, I think we always have a certain amount of that anyway. We can't assure you that there won't be somebody whose ox has been gored, if you will, by this. What we tried to do was to meet with as many people whose ox was in the process of being gored and try to satisfy them that try to come to some middle ground.
Can you provide us with, if this is appropriate, Mr. Chairman, can you provide us with some sense of that? And I don't know whether it's a list or...
If you look,
it
may not be what you're looking for, but at the back there is reference to the licensing task force, which is a list of individuals who participated in the task force and presented many ideas and conflicting ideas. And what came out as the bill was basically a consensus in which the division is being responsible for regulation and the various industry representatives were overall comfortable with. That's not to say that someone liked some things differently than their own particular special interest method of operation, but it was something that Director Walsh would work very hard at developing a broad base support.
Okay, then the next thing that I'd like to get to, and it's probably the most succinct of it, I'm interested in ensuring, Ian, yes you are, that none of these are rolling over one of these or two of these for a competitive note. Okay, fairness may be fine, but not trying to bury someone in the process because they want to compete and take their business. Or, and you may have not a single inkling of anything like that taking place. But I want to make sure government is not put into the position of burying one at the expense.
I think that it's probably one way to respond to that is to note that we a number of these things, including this issue on clerical, for example, have been addressed by the division in the past. And in some cases, what we are doing, in many cases, what we are doing is putting into clearer statutory language what has been our practice. For example, was it 88? In 1988, there was an order issued that basically dealt with clerical people in office. Director Roller, when he was director, very specifically addressed what clerical people could do. So that continued to be a point of discussion, and we felt that it was appropriate to make it clearer in the language. The licensees felt a little bit more comfortable with clearer language in statute than they would with, obviously, an order or a bulletin that addresses the subject. So where we had a practice that was, let's say, ongoing, we've attempted to codify it. I guess our view is that if somebody was doing it differently than the previous orders and bulletins had already enunciated, they're already operating improperly, or at least not in accord with the existing orders and bulletins or regulations. And I guess this was an opportunity as we went through this process for them to make known what they felt about some of those things. We had some real heated discussions from time to time on some issues. So I can't tell you that there isn't somebody out there who's still real unhappy about the way the thing went.
Does it all tie in also with certification and certain levels of people and
training? This particular point does not. So there's really two major issues in this proposed legislation. One is a whole series of models that directly affect accreditation. And then the other is the consolidation, and that's what I prefer to call it, the consolidation and slight restructure of the licensing operation. I guess it's not so slight, I mischaracterize that, because we're basically going to a single producer license as opposed to having three distinct separate licenses. And also offering a trainee function, which hasn't been there in the past. Dan will get to that. But effectively, the trainee function in the past, in order to operate, would have required a license. Now, There's basically the time that person has to learn and operate as a trainee before they must take and pass a test. So that's something that's very different from what has existed before, and we're content with that. One other point is the whole purpose of licensing from an insurance regulatory standpoint, or for that matter, for any regulatory standpoint, is that you're attempting to assure, at least we hope, that there's a level of professionalism that the people who are out there conducting that particular business are indeed capable professionally of doing the things they're doing. And so we look at it in that light, and then of course we get tempered by what others feel is practical. And to the greatest degree we can, we try to do what is practical on this whole structure. Whether we've accomplished that or not, I think others will speak to, but I think we've come awfully close.
I've covered ground that you've already covered, but I don't know.
I wouldn't worry about that.
Everybody should know about us, so I don't think we've really dealt with the issues you brought up.
Right.
And I think it's fair to say that overall the revision grants broader authority than the current statute and the bulletin grants to the work that can be done by people who are unlicensed. And that was an area where industry had concern. We also recognized that the method of operation of licensees changes over time with new technology or a change in cast character, a change in insurance needs in Alaska, and included a provision that would allow, by regulation, developing exceptions that were not enumerated in 010. And basically that was so that we could respond to developments that we couldn't foresee, and also works as a safeguard that if inadvertently someone is unfairly disadvantaged, that problem can be quickly rectified. That it wouldn't have to wait for an entire legislative process. Meanwhile, the person is sinking. Section 49 is a section which changes F, and again deals with NEIC accreditation and reciprocity after January 1, 1984. Section 50.
Hold for a second. There's a couple of sections like Section 49 where basically what happens is it goes back and replaces a section that is being newly proposed with this bill. So in Section 48, there's a Section F that will say one thing as a new proposal, and then Section 49 will come along and replace that effective January 1, 1994 with language that more aptly fits the reciprocity provisions for accreditation. So we'll try to note where those occur, but this is one of them. So that and that was the easiest way to do it because this has a different effective date than Section 48.
Right. Can you explain why we're going with the different effective dates? And just to get industry on tune, so they can take some time to gear up for it?
Because there are provisions that are required for accreditation that don't kick in or shouldn't kick in until 1/1/94. And so that needs to have a different effective date than something now because there's only a few states right now who are accredited. There's about
six or eight
states that are currently accredited. We would expect by the end of the year there will be considerably more. But in the meantime, if you put a reciprocity provision in here that references and requires accreditation, that means you can only effectively deal with companies that are coming from those six or eight states.
Sure.
On 1/1/94, the expectation is that all the states that we would want to allow to do these things will be accredited. Yeah. And so therefore you have a reciprocity provision with a new trigger date.
Sure.
Section 51 address qualifications. What we did, again for simplicity, was combine two old sections into one, so it would be much simpler. Section 50 had editorial changes to reflect the new biennial license. Section 51 brought forth many of the old sections of Section 90. We deleted provisions in old 90 that referenced particular types of licenses because those were all relocated into the subsequent articles which dealt with each type of license. We addressed some current practice regarding firm licenses, relocated the current provision regarding adopting regulations in regard to education and experience. Section 52 created a new section which in one place incorporated all of the requirements that the licensees would have to notify the division and the method of notifying. We found in the past problems where we were not told that somebody had moved, that somebody had not been told that somebody had changed their business name, had not been told when somebody had left the firm, had not been told when the principal or manager of a firm had changed.
Why do you need to be told that the principal or manager of the firm got convicted of the DWI?
We just want to be informed of it. And obviously we're looking at something that would address...
A misdemeanor could be shoplifting, it could be burglary, it could fish and game charge, you know.
Where it would trigger an action by the division, or where we would expect it to trigger an action by the division, as if misdemeanor or the felony involved something of a fiduciary nature, if they were stealing money, or if they were embezzling, or things like that. Because an insurance licensee is required to maintain a fiduciary account, we get very concerned with...
It just doesn't say that in here.
No, that's true.
It says any misdemeanor or felony, they've got to notify within 30 days.
That's true, but there are a couple of classes of misdemeanor or felony that we need to get to, and it's simpler.
Further defined someplace else, so it should
no,
be
it
wasting
isn't.
Your time.
It isn't.
And well, then you might want to slip that formality into that one to indicate the types you're after. Somebody will jump on that. If anybody ever, like me, wades through this, I don't think most of the legislature will.
Typically, what you find in most states, and I'm not disagreeing, I'm just saying, typically what you find in most states is the broader view, all whether it includes things that you would want to know about or not. Mm-hmm. For example, if you have a life insurance salesman or a health insurance salesman and who's had past convictions of child abuse or something like that, you would not want that person out there selling insurance, or who has had convictions of something that are physically doing physical harm to others. So I guess what I'm saying is there's a fiduciary concern, then there's the physical harm concern. And rather than try to get into specifics on each of those, we just left it blanket.
I just bring it to your attention. I don't have a real problem with it. I just thought it was kind of interesting. I wanted 30 days notice if a guy got convicted of catching too many trout.
Yeah,
that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I concur with Taylor said. Initial concern, but I would go further and would like to see an amendment that would be more specific. I know in the real estate industry there was one at one time that appeared to work well. And if someone does catch a couple trout illegally, that doesn't. I think it needs to be itemized.
Yeah, and again, it's important to distinguish between the responsibility to notify the division and the discretion director would have in whether to pursue suspension or revocation.
Yeah, exactly. But technically, if the notification were not given, then technically that person could lose their license if they didn't send notification of a misdemeanor conviction. I mean, the way I read it, I looked it up here. The wording is very specific and clear and narrow, or too broad. And I think it needs to be much more well-defined. And I would look forward to seeing an amendment to that effect.
Well, either way you go on this.
I've made a note on it, so
let me just make an additional suggestion. Either way you go on this, you need to have some operable language in here that makes this thing self-enforcing. In other words, we have what's called an NCIC tie-in with the National Computer. Any time somebody's arrested, booked if the arrest results in a booking. Prints are rolled, photographs are taken, and that's all shipped back to the FBI on a computer. It's called the National Central, I don't know, NCIC.
Every time
you book? Every time. And for this thing to be enforcing, or be enforceable, you as an agency would have no idea if I, as an agent, were convicted of a misdemeanor. You'd have no way of knowing that. You're mandating that I send you the information. I'm the last person in the world that's going to want to send you that information if it affects my license, aren't I? You have no other way of finding that information out other than reading the newspapers and hoping you catch it yourself or one of their competitors knows about it, and they'll send it to you. To make the thing self-enforcing, there's a provision we have, and I'm trying to remember where we've used it, whether it was used it with child support enforcement or somebody, that meant, that said whenever Department of Public Safety cites somebody for it, that you have a listing of your, because you're only going to have one kind of license now anyhow. All those people who are licensed, you put their names into the same computer so that when that computer does a kickback, it kicks back direct to you. You don't have to ask anybody for it or anything else. You just get a little printout from them. It says, Joni Schmaltz was picked up for doing such and such. Then you can find out whether or not it resulted in a conviction, which is all you're concerned about.
Does that language then go into public safety's statutes?
Yeah, you put it in there and they kick the thing back out to you. It makes it self-enforcing. It makes it a lot simpler for everybody in that way.
We love additional tools.
You don't have to do it.
May I interject something here? My name is Linda Brunette, and I'm the licensing supervisor. We, at one time, tried to contact, or we contacted public safety and asked them if we could become a primary user because of the concern we had regarding people selling the insurance who may be convicted of a possible felony. And they denied us that request, and we are considered a secondary user, which does not allow us that provision or that requirement where we could submit a list to them asking for convictions if they had any of those names on file. So we have checked into it. Maybe we can check into it again.
You see, if we you were asking for cooperation from the department, as the legislature considering a policy change, we can order them to do it.
Okay.
By merely putting a one-liner in here that says, thou shalt do this.
That's great.
We do have one other source.
So I suggest that as an amendment that could be very helpful to you. Not only in this regard, but in some others, because right now, it's funny that if I'm convicted of a misdemeanor DWI, I have signed a little waiver with my insurance company because they won't sell me insurance unless part of my signature encompasses that waiver. And it's a waiver of my rights of privacy. Every insurance company has that same waiver. Every insured person signs it. So if I get picked up DWI in Albuquerque, my insurance agent in Wrangell knows about it within about 10 days. And now how can that possibly happen that it goes through the Albuquerque Police Department, the doom-to-doom, and it ends up in Mutual of Screw Rob and Taylor? And where is it? Wrangell, Alaska. And they're coming after me saying, sorry, your insurance is now canceled, kid. You got picked up. Please buy our SR-22 at only $11,000 for 1 year, and we'll give you the least liability coverage the world offers. You know, now, they can know that, but how come my own insurance agent, director here, to protect me, the people of the state of Alaska, how come he can't get that information out of my own state troopers? Isn't that incredible, David?
Yeah. Well, I have to admit that when that process that Linda has described was going on, we were more than a little frustrated. Because that was the purpose for having the fingerprint cards and a number of other things that we were doing, and it was forgotten. But I like what you've suggested.
And I think you'll find there are people who are familiar enough with the language and the way those things work. But there is a provision, because we've had it on the floor a couple times. It's been several years now since we attacked this one before.
We do have in place a process through the National Association of Insurance Commissioners where we report our problem children, if you will, to them, as do other states to them. And so when we run a name against that, if there's been a past problem with their insurance license, they will send that back to us. And we routinely do ask for that kind of information. Now, that's an internal kind of thing, so they'll tell us about it. So once they know that a person is licensed, are trying to be licensed here, then they'll let us know about it. But what you're talking about would be a great asset in terms of pointing out about things that come through public safety.
Right.
So,
that would be only within the state of Alaska.
Oh, no,
national. In other words, the troopers get nationwide information into their...
Get the information that I've had a misdemeanor problem very quickly.
But
especially
I would
since
still,
it's a conference system.
Yeah, but I would, but it's the capabilities there, but I would still be concerned over what kind of information, what kind of felonies it would be, you know, or misdemeanor.
Well, yeah, I think you want to resolve the definitional aspect first.
Yeah.
We have no problem with that.
Yeah.
I understand exactly.
It's really a very small group of people. It's only people selling insurance in the state. In our state, we're not probably talking much over 300.
Oh, no.
200?
Several thousand.
Got several thousand people in Alaska selling insurance to 500,000 of them?
Either in or who are licensed in Alaska. I think there's like 3,500 now.
Are there really?
5,800 licensees.
5,800?
Mm-hmm.
Holy cow.
That is a lot.
Not all of them are full time, but there are 5,800 licensees.
They're not all residing in the state.
Oh, I see, but licensed.
Licensed to, right, Alaska. To business here.
Do you have a recollection of how many are non-residents?
I think we've been running about 48% of non-residents.
That's an insurance agent for every 10 of us. There's more people. There's enough people in this room to support 1.5 insurance agents, according.
You think the prices would be cheaper though?
That's why the cost of insurance is so high. We've got to support all those.
Is this on tape, Mr. Chief?
Actually, their exams are quite difficult.
My wife is one of them, I think. I think she let hers terminate about 2 years ago now. She's no longer part of that profession. So I think she terminated hers a couple of years ago. She got out of the business.
Okay.
You follow lines like that. Sections 53 through 55, revised controlled business section. Controlled business is when an insurance producer is generating most of their business from companies that they own or family members or so forth. Revised to reflect biennial license name changes. Adds a provision to prohibit receipt of compensation that they aren't supposed to have because they shouldn't have a license if it's a controlled business. And is revised just to reference the general penalty section for a controlled business violation. Section 56.
I'm trying to understand there on 53 and 54. What's this 50% stuff?
That's basically the definition of controlled business. In order to be a legitimate licensee, you have to have more business from the general public than what you're generating from stuff you own or control.
If a large corporation came in and said, I want a license, and all they really wanted the license for was to write it for themselves, that would not be a licensable issue. As a matter of fact,
that's a little deal to protect the insurance agent, isn't it?
Probably.
Why are we
The fact is the licensee, assume not the licensee, the large buyer of insurance could effectively go direct to any number of insurers.
So
can the small guy, correct.
You're preventing every small guy from going direct.
No, they can go directly.
They can go direct to, there's a number of insurers that will write business direct with anybody.
Without
an agent involved.
Okay, but...
So what this is really addressing is the person who goes through the license process for the sole reason of buying insurance for himself.
And collecting commissions.
And collecting commissions.
Ah, okay. Okay.
Section 56.
I don't know if it's good or bad.
No, I'm not going to do it. That's what I'm saying. I don't have to get a commission.
Section 56. Clarifies the information provided in the application process must be truthful. Section 57 makes some editorial changes in regard to the penalties for willful misrepresentation. Section 58 explicitly provides the director with the ability to require current information of the type made in or supplemental to the application, such as at the time of renewal. Section 59 combines two old sections, provides some clarification regarding principals and managers, incorporates a procedure with regard to letters of clearance from other states for licensees who are moving up here to become a resident licensee, and includes an explicit definition of the waiver of examination in regard to limited licenses. Section 60 is the accreditation timing. So is 61. Section 62 is revised to make it more convenient to provide examinations for licensees as well as convenience to the director and applicants. Removes the limitation of licensees. The exams can be done only in a Lancet. Section 63 revises the appointment process. Again, this is a more significant change and a philosophical change. Under current law, an agent can't get an agent's license until they've been appointed by some insurer. We felt that, A, we didn't particularly care whether they had an appointment or not before they got the license or afterwards. Besides, by going to the single producer license, it wasn't a matter of great significance. So what we do need a record of the appointments. So we revised the procedure so that we would receive notification of an appointment, we'd acknowledge it. It was up to the parties to make any corrections. That was so that if somebody reports an appointment to us, and we acknowledge it, but the insurer, the managing general agent, the insurance intermediary manager, never intended to appoint that person, they have the opportunity to raise their hand and say, no, you know, they must have sent in the appointment themselves. And we passed off the burden to the insurers, the managing general agents, to supervise the appointment process, rather than having division staff review managing general agent contracts to see if the MGA really had authority to appoint that agent. We felt we just receive it, we process it, send an acknowledgement to everybody. It was their responsibility to make sure that what we received was proper.
Yes.
I guess I'm a little confused. It seemed to me that the way these things work is that, and the reason you have to buy out the local insurance agent, you can't really go into competition with them, is because he's got a lock on the major companies that are going to be dealing in your area, and that's this letter of commitment stuff. I mean, I can't just take your little license, go out here and set up shop right now.
Yes. With this new process, you would be able
with
to.
With the new process. Old process. I'm talking about what's existing today. I'm talking about something that may go into effect in 94.
Under the current process, if you have a broker's license, you effectively can go to any insurer who is willing to write for you, whether they represent somebody in town or
right.
not.
Right. I'm not talking about a broker. I'm talking about...
As to agency appointments,
right.
There are insurers who, for example, in a community the size of Anchorage will have many appointments there because, in their view, there's a sufficient population base to do that. But there are, admittedly, insurers who will look at Petersburg or Wrangell and say, that's really a small population base. We don't want any more than one down there. And so they'll issue one appointment, and they won't give another one to anybody else.
Right.
That happens.
Which means in smaller communities here in southeast Alaska, you don't end up with a choice.
That's often true.
And nobody's going to business in competition with them because they've got a locked-in monopoly.
If you want
to go into business with them, you've got to buy out the old agent and all of his blue sky just so you can get the letters of appointment.
I have no doubt that happens.
Right. Well,
why don't we put
a little daylight on that operation?
That's effectively what this will accomplish, I believe.
Right. But it still doesn't get around the problem of the letter of appointment. All it does is it says they're going to do the tracking, we're just going to issue.
But what it does do is it still allows that other person to get a license without having to go through an appointment process.
Yeah, it gets rid of part of the chicken and egg thing.
Right. So part of the problem right now is right now there's a lesser qualification to be an agent than there is to be a broker.
Right.
You don't have to have as high a score on a test and things like that. And right now, in order to be an agent, you have to have a company that appoints you first. What this will do is say the relationship between the company, the insured, and the insurer will be up to those three parties. And you can decide whether they want to operate as an agent or as a broker. If they're going to operate as an agent, you don't have to see the appointment first. They can get that appointment after the fact. But it lets all licensees have access to the marketplace. Now, the insurer may still not be willing to deal with somebody who they've not appointed. But at least it gives everybody the ability to pass that level of qualification, one level of qualification. It gives them the ability to go out there and sell insurance.
Yeah. I thought I was picking up on that change, but I wasn't sure.
You got it.
But it's an impediment to people wanting to get into the business.
Right.
Is removed.
Good. We'll just start.
Section 64, again, references new license types, revises the method in which an annual renewal fee would be charged to insurers if the director so chose. Section 65 revises the form and contents of licenses to reflect types and scopes. Basically, this allows the division to issue the licenses that it has been.
Said you're going to put your real name down.
See, I read that. I'm going to bring that up again.
I don't want you to use any more of them phony AKAs now, Penny.
She doesn't look like a Pacific Rim to me.
I work for Pacific Rim, man. Yes, man. Is there something wrong?
No.
This is insurance, not real
estate. I think you knew that.
Yeah, but you ought to see the real estate bill that's coming next.
I saw parts of it.
Not our section.
Good, be happy.
There were some technical changes. One provision of the statute requires that the business records be kept at the place listed on the license, which was real inconvenient for folks who used a post office box as their mailing address. So we provide both the mailing address and the physical address. And again, to have the license reflect the DBA under which, or DBAs, since some entities can have multiple offices with a different name. The limited licensee section is substantially revised. What we did here was incorporate all the limited licenses. There was a title insurer, fraternal society, and then there were some others that have been added regarding disability over the years, and put them all in one section as clearly defined as limited licensees, bail bondsmen, for example. So there was common handling, common standards for all these types of very limited special use
and one
type of limited license.
And one place to look.
Right.
Addressed the ability to waive bond requirements.
Standard retired insurance user license, I think, is a
yes.
Change.
Yeah, we also included a retired insurance producer license, which basically addresses the problem of someone who is no longer out there soliciting business and binding it, but has some old business which is still generating a commission. The current law says you have to be licensed if you want to receive commission, and we felt that if someone who's retired and got a little limited license as a retiree, and it makes it real clear that they can receive the commission on the old business that they handled, but they can't otherwise transact business.
So they can't initiate new business, but they
right.
can receive
right.
payment from a transaction that occurred during when they were fully
right.
licensed.
Right.
I like that. Can you do that for me, too? sure on their real estate.
You guys give residuals?
No, they do. See, they do, yeah.
That's why these insurance guys
remind,
make a fortune off
tomorrow,
residuals.
Remind me tomorrow when the real estate one comes up.
Sure.
Okay. Hey, you see that mostly, I think, on the life side rather than on the...
As long as the payments keep coming in, you get paid a percentage of your commission. Well, the trouble is, though, you want your commission up front.
Yeah, that's...
These insurance guys take their commission over the life of the contract.
50 years later, yeah.
It's good if you build a lot of them.
This reminds me of a problem, which is the title of these bills. So we don't do these things. Go too far. Mike, could you come up with a title for us that's a little bit more specific than what it is, which I think is an accolade for insurance. I know it won't be easy, but anything you can do.
You call it the marathon?
No,
or what do you call it?
Oh, someone called it
that. That would be promise. I mean, that's...
Well, no, I think the idea is...
In other words, it sounds almost like...
We are trying to do... we're trying to do a lot here, and I hate to have the bill reach a point where other things get added in. You know,
I think that's a fine title.
Yeah, I think it's a fine title, too. I could just see things like unrelated provisions, like tort reform, other things that could bog us down on the floor. I guess that's my fear, or the Senate floor, excuse me.
Mr. Chairman, the position of our division has been that unless it relates to insurance, it would not fit into this title.
Right.
And there are certain categories, I think, that you can clearly... that would not fit under this title, one of which is tort reform. As you generally think of the subject, any amendments to 09 are civil procedures.
Right.
Would not fit under here, unless it relates to insurance.
How about if someone wanted to put in a... I mean, I guess I see your point. I'm not sure if we can solve it. The division's done so much work here with a very clear focus, you know, trying to reach the standard for accreditation and trying to consolidate and revise our, you know, our standards in these areas. Someone could put on an amendment to eliminate a particular form of insurance, for instance, a very to get rid of credit insurance or get rid of something else.
Well, we've had legislation where people are concerned about premiums. I mean, I've seen that, three different times now. We've had premium insurance.
Right.
I mean, legislation dealing with you paid a premium tax if you were outside the state, you didn't pay a premium tax if you were inside the state. Then we had a big fight over that. So that would certainly fall within this.
Right. I think there'd be a lot of things.
Well, anything within Title 21 is certainly fair game.
I can think of some oddball stuff or some other things that might get thrown in there. But most of them are wars that have already been fought and are resolved. I don't know the big one, Penny. The tort reform stuff, I agree with him. I think it's outside of it.
Okay. Well, I just would hate to see us on the floor with an amendment to, you know, that sort of a sweeping change, which may or may not be a good idea, but it isn't fitting with the goals here, which are, you know, trying to reach these new levels of responsibility.
Of course, it's a good idea. They can amend the title anyhow.
In the House, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is this a Senate bill?
No, but we'll at least keep the Senate to our subject matter.
This is essentially for the word employee may not be right, but it's the providers of insurance, isn't it?
No, it also relates to the assets of the entity itself.
Well, I mean, but it's of the corporations, the companies, the people. I mean, it's not dealing with kinds of coverage.
I just made a general remark there. I can't imagine. It's probably the world's longest title.
It's pretty broad spectrum. I struggled a little bit with how to come up with something that was a little more refined, because we've had the same concerns that somebody would come along and add some things to it that might put the whole thing in limbo, which very much concerns us, particularly with a bill this size. It's a difficult enough process as it is. I don't have a suggestion. So
okay, well, I'll just drop that for now. Let's go back to wherever you were.
Okay.
I think we just finished 67.
Yeah. Section 68, scope of licenses, revised to reflect additional license types and to allow more accurate, more flexible identification of what the scope of the license is going to be. Section 69 revises technically the licensing of insurance vending machines. Section 70.
But they got rid of it, didn't they?
I don't know.
I haven't seen it.
I'm come up.
Yeah, I haven't seen it last couple of years.
I'm usually heading towards the exit.
They only have a couple volumes, at least on vending machine law, in case anybody ever wants to vote one in. We'll be ready for them.
Direct supervision.
They got to sit there, right there. Section.
You don't want to sold to anybody under 21.
Section 70. Formerly, there had been something called a broker bond requirement. And we revamped the section to be a generic treatment of how bonds that would be required for a particular specialty would be treated, with certain specific requirements that apply to all bonds. Also provide that an entity that had multiple locations or was required because of multiple licenses to have different bonds could lump them all in one bond for simplicity and efficiency. Section 71.
No, stand, hold a second. It also addresses with a little more clarity the situation where you have alternatives to a bond. There was language put in a year or two ago that allowed that broker to have an alternative to the bond.
It's so a property or something. Some of the things posted as security.
It just allowed the director to establish by regulation alternatives to the bond. And what this does is basically assert that the director can do that by regulation. It makes clear that any of the alternatives have to provide the same protection as the bond would. Section 71, 72, 73 deal with Section 270, deals with appointment of the agent to service a process for non-residents, and reflects the new license types. Section 73 incorporates retaliatory language, which is currently located in Chapter 09 and applies only to insurers and their appointed agents, and extends it to any type of licensing so that the division can protect Alaskans from discrimination by other states in the issuance of licenses, taxes.
On this reciprocity stuff.
Yeah.
If we don't get reciprocity, we don't get it.
Right.
That's what you're doing.
And currently it only applies to insurers and agents, now apply across the board. Section 74, place of business.
Not apply across the board. Two insurance companies themselves.
Other kinds of licenses, like surplus lines, managing general agents, reinsurance intermediaries.
Okay.
Place of business revised to include new license types. Public display is revised for the handling of all types of licenses. Section 350, requirement for records is clarified to and expand to all of the license types, and to make the records have to be maintained in sufficient detail to document what's been done. Section 77 clarifies that fiduciary account must be maintained for all types of licensees to benefit the person entitled to the money. That's a little broader than the current language, which left some loopholes in terms of for whose benefit the money was received. Clarifies the handling of the firm versus individuals in the firm, and establishes an alternative to a separate trust accounting for commingling money. And I'll get to that in 365.
Why do you exclude premium taxes and fees from that?
Why
77. All money except that made payable to the insurer representing premium taxes and fees, premiums or return premiums received by the licensee, shall be received in the fiduciary account of the licensee.
Its language is kind of awkward, but basically what it means is that all the money they receive for premium taxes and premiums and fees, except that which is made payable to the insurer goes into the fiduciary account.
And since the premium taxes and
premium tax
fees are payable to us into that, right?
The premium tax,
when you say premium tax, to what I'm thinking?
No, I think you have it right. This will also affect surplus line brokers
right.
Now. Right? So a surplus line broker, when he sells an insurance policy, collects a premium, but he collects a separate premium tax. It's listed on the declaration page in a policy, but it shows as a separate feature. So he's effectively collecting premium and premium tax.
And a filing.
And a filing fee. Each of those, we're saying here, has to go into his fiduciary account. He will ultimately pay the state the premium taxes and fees. The premiums he will remit to the insurer.
Sounded to me as though it was accepting out of the fiduciary
the
account the premium taxes and fees.
No, the exception is an exception for that money made payable to the insurer, which means if you write a check to the insurer directly, then that goes right
it doesn't
right
have to go through your
doesn't have to go through your fiduciary account. Everything else does.
Okay, I think I'm understanding. I work hard at this. Get done like I do in the insurance business.
You betcha.
Including one of those licenses.
I don't know why everybody's laughing, Mr. Kelly.
It's not a bad business, is it?
I like it from my end.
Yeah. Section 78 is revised to require restitution of misappropriated money. In other words, if someone takes money out of a fiduciary account that they shouldn't, the director may require restitution. Some provision that doesn't currently exist in statute. Some editorial changes in 79, 80, 81, the definition of fiduciary account is moved to the general definition section of the chapter. Section 82 is a new section. With the trust account reg and the existing fiduciary account law, certain sophisticated insurance producers who have very complex accounting systems and nationwide sweeps and all that kind of stuff couldn't comply because of the way their integrated accounting systems are set up. And they requested that we work with them to come up with an alternative. That's what 365 is. And basically, it allows the director to exempt them from certain parts of the application of trust accounting regulations, which don't work well with their accounting systems. The public protection is established by having them establish a deposit or a bond that represents 10% of their annual Alaska premiums, which is basically the amount of money that they should be retaining in the trust account. It also has some requirements relating to accounting by a independent CPA who's reviewing their accounting systems and controls to make sure that they are going to be maintaining the fiduciary responsibilities that they have. Section 83.
That's when I've got a question.
Sure.
The only reason this thing is in here is to prevent kickbacks, isn't it?
The fiduciary account system?
No, the sharing compensation. 83.
Well, kickback, sharing of commission is okay. What it prevents is sharing commission with people who aren't licensed.
That's what I mean, with the customer. This prevents you from sharing it with the customer.
Or with somebody who brings business to a broker who doesn't have a license to begin with and who's not involved in it.
Okay, a rainmaker. Yeah. You send somebody out to generate a little business for you, right?
Right.
Okay, you can't share it with them.
Correct.
But what it really prevents you from doing is, I'm the ABC washboard company. I've got 1,000 employees. I've been doing business over here with Joe Schmaltz Agency and Brokerage House. The other guy comes to me and he says, hey, I'm willing to do business with you too, but you know, I'm selling the same lines he's selling, same product. I'm going to get the same amount of commission he's getting. I'll cut you a good deal. Instead of me taking the full 15% commission, I'll take 7.5%. I'll reduce your premium by 7.5%. You get the kickback. What's wrong with that?
That's
the only reason this thing's in here, is to prevent that guy from doing that.
Actually, that's treated in a couple of ways. One, it's illegal for an insurer or its agent to rebate premium.
No, it's not illegal. Every other business does it.
We make it illegal.
You're talking about a different statute.
Existing law does this, Dave. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Right. He's not arguing about cases.
What this section focuses on licensees.
Mm-hmm.
As you'll see in a little while, we address the problem you've identified in terms of a brokerage arrangement, and basically allow someone, most often large insureds or government entities, who put out an RFP, request for proposals for brokerage services, and they will be able, as you'll see later, to do it on a fee basis. In other words,
The broker always could. He could work either for the person buying or the person selling.
That's not always been very clear.
The way the current law is structured, it would have to be fee plus commission.
Yeah.
We've revised that so that it could be fee.
Fee only.
With any commission offset.
Uh-huh. That's one option.
The other option is that it be commission only, no fee.
It's two options.
The third option is that it can be a combination of fee and commission, and it's negotiable between the parties as to whether all or part of the commission is used to offset the fee.
And there's disclosure.
Disclosure to the client.
Right.
But what's wrong with
effectively?
Why do we as a state need to protect what I think is an illicit monopolistic relationship going on between the carriers and their chosen few out here and their determination of what the percentile
That's what we fixed.
You haven't fixed it. You've guaranteed it forever. I cannot get these guys to do that unless I'm a major insurer.
But that's not sharing compensation.
Why can't I, with my little house in Wrangell,
contact
four different agents and say, because I know they're all getting anywhere from the 12, 13, 15% premium kick on this thing. And contact three or four of them and say, I tell you what, I know what you're picking up on this thing. You give me a knockoff of $300, I'll place with you. Why can't I shop the market? I can't. You guys prevent me from being able to shop the market by putting this in the law.
If you use a broker, or if you use a person who is as a broker, and tell them that this is what I'm willing to pay for the placement, then they can shop that X commission. You can say, I'm willing to pay for your services X dollars. Which of you brokers out there wants to deal with that? And one of them will say, okay, I'll do that. That means he gets the X dollars that you've told him you'll pay him for his fee, the placement for all the services that go with that account, and he buys that X commission.
Yeah, the same companies thing. Then make it real simple. They just, with brokers of that type, they don't give them a commission.
That's up to the broker.
They put it right in the policy or something. I mean, they'll find a way to dodge that.
But it will be a different rate. It'll be a different rate than somebody who's out there selling that as an agent, because the agent's share can only come from the commission.
So myself and four neighbors are very sophisticated, and we go ahead and we hire ourselves a broker. We'll be able to do this only in the future, in 1994.
This will kick in as soon as the law kicks in.
Why can't we just take this out? If they want to be monopolistic, I mean, they're already protected. They can't sue them under antitrust.
I'll give you one example, and this has been a concern in enough states that they've pretty much stuck with their rebate clause. And that is, you can have a town like Petersburg where the premium income is probably not the highest in the world, but you've got somebody there who's willing to service the business and receive a commission. Somebody in Anchorage says, by golly, I can do it a lot cheaper because I'm a big firm. I'll just roll down there and sell as much as I can, and I'll cut the commission in half or to a fourth. I'll buy all that business, drive that person out of business. It's the anti-monopolistic feature that has concerned regulators and therefore has led to keeping that provision in there. So you get your Anchorage broker comes in and just basically buys the business. And the person in Petersburg is not going to be able to cope with that, not for very long.
How does this prevent that?
It prevents it on an agency basis. In other words, to the degree that you've got, it prevents it by saying you can't rebate your commission. If you're selling a product and receiving a commission.
Is that this section says that or other places?
No, that's other provisions in the law already say that.
I think the point of Representative Taylor's after is why not take out this section?
Basically, this is an ambulance chaser provision.
Right.
It prevents a licensee from getting someone to go run around, sign up a bunch of business, and then split the commission with that person who's unlicensed.
And it also prevents them from rebating back.
I just want to separate these discussions. Are we going to get to that section we're talking about rebates? Okay, we are going to have that discussion, I think. And I think you've raised good points, Representative Taylor. This one is just this splitting it with others who are unlicensed, which is sort of a different issue here.
True.
It's almost an issue of you've got to be licensed in order to sell insurance, right?
Right.
Yeah.
That's what it comes down to.
But that's,
which is a premise of our...
From being a consumer who's purchasing insurance.
Right, which we will talk about. I think that's an important discussion, which there'll be a lot of views on. But I just want to get through this section so we can... When we talk about the point Representative Taylor's making, we have that section in front of us, not a different section. Maybe you can note where that section is so we'll remember when we get there.
Okay. Section 84 is revised to establish the biennial license renewal. Explicitly states that for renewal, someone must continue to be qualified. It allows the processing discretion so that the renewal process can be spread out for the 2-year period so it can provide better service. It creates a new category for a lapsed license where someone doesn't renew it and gives them a limited period of time in which to reinstate the license if it has become lapsed. Addresses limitations regarding the term and renewal of trainee licenses. Section 85 has some minor editorial changes provide a better match to actually happens. Section 86 is a new section which provides for a hearing and order on a violation, similar to the existing procedure in 36 regarding investigations, issuance of cease and desist orders, establishes penalties if a person violates the cease and desist order. Section 87 is revised to reflect the biennial renewal process. Enumerates causes for denial, non-renewal, suspension, revocation of licenses, adds a number of named ones such as failing to pass an exam, cheating on an exam, having a license suspended or revoked in another jurisdiction, forgery, accepting business from a person that's not licensed if the licensee knew or should have known that that person is not licensed.
Is that what they call twisting?
No.
What's twisting?
Twisting is misrepresentation.
Well, they got
typically
number twisting. Six. It says twisting in violation of 2136.050 or rebating in violation of 2136.100 by a licensee or rather.
And those are specific things that are prohibited in Chapter 36.
Yeah, I understand that. What is twisting?
Those are not different than what is the current law. There's a minor editorial change. There's nothing substantive there. But what twisting is a form of misrepresentation where you misrepresent your product, typically done in life insurance. You misrepresent your product with the idea of having a person trade in the old product to buy yours. For example, the whole life is where it occurred substantially. And misrepresentation would usually occur where they were misstating what the values were in the old policy or undervaluing what those values would be, saying that, well, this one that we're going to sell you is going to cost you fewer dollars per month or per year or whatever, without at all looking to what other values were already coming from.
policy in terms of dividends, policy, cash values, things like that. That's twisted.
Section 88, the procedure is included for the director to condition a license in order to protect the public from injury or potential. Currently, there's no provision that allows the director to limit what a licensee may do. This will allow basically matching the penalty with the crime, so to speak. Someone for whom it's safe for them to continue to be selling insurance, but they have a problem with maintaining their trust account. The director can condition the license so that they don't have access to trust account funds. Section 89 is a section that precludes somebody from profiting while their license is suspended or revoked. Section 90 is rewritten penalty section, which makes clear that the penalties apply to any violation of the chapter. We distinguish between willful violations and for someone knew that they weren't supposed to do it, a violation which may not have been willful. Allow for penalties to be paid in installments over a year. Section 91 revises the surrender of license, for a biennial license, is more specific in the time period that someone has to surrender. Section 92 requires surrendering the license if it could be reissued to reflect any changes. Section 93 goes on forever because it's all new articles.
What is an insurance producer?
It's someone who used to be an agent and or broker or solicitor. It's just somebody who's out there producing insurance. It's a license category that would include an agent, who's someone who's representing an insurance company trying to get you to buy their insurance, and it would include somebody who's a broker, someone who's an independent contractor who's representing your interests in terms of fulfilling your insurance needs.
Basically, what this whole thing does is that it replaces the old agent or broker license and solicitor, replaces those three licenses with one license. It then allows
this is the one license.
This is
insurance
the one
producer.
Insurance producer is what it's going to be called. That insurance producer can then establish the relationships that he either feels he needs or he wants in operating with an insurance company or with an insurer. So he may for one account with an insurer say, I'll be your broker, and he operates that as a broker. Or he may have an appointment from an insurer to act on behalf of the insurer as their appointee. Mm-hmm. But that gives him the option.
At this point, it's easier to refer to the sections in Title 27. So 530 establishes qualifications that apply to insurance producers. It includes the old broker bond requirement, exempting a person who only acts as an agent who does not receive money that has to be put into a fiduciary account. Relocates some stuff dealing with Society limited insurance producer licenses and dealing with variable contracts, which are annuities. New section, training insurance producers. This is a new concept which allows someone who has not passed the test that would qualify them for an insurance producer license to start work and do certain limited activities under the close supervision and direction of a licensee and work towards passing the exams. We found in the past, especially in rural areas which don't have easy access to taking examinations or where the pool of trained insurance people is small, that they need the ability to have someone who can provide immediate assistance in the operation of the business while they gain information, gain knowledge, so they can pass the tests. 550 addresses the appointment of insurance producer as an agent. Basically requires a written agency agreement between the insurer and the insurance producer, sets out some basic requirements for